Hello. Welcome to Triangle Radio Reading Service. My name is John Ivy. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you articles from the double issue of Sports Illustrated, January 2008. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the first article is entitled Escape from Jonestown, and has a picture here of, in the left-hand corner, of hundreds of dead bodies. And then down in the left-hand, right-hand corner on the next page, it has a father and son, and the father is leaning over the shoulder of his son, and looks like he's getting ready to play in a basketball game. Well, let's find out how basketball gave life to a son and grandson of the infamous cult leader, Jim Jones, by Gary Smith. Tell me, does it get sweeter than this? The big, handsome kid gliding to the glass in warm-up drills. That's your son. He's the best high school player in the city. One look at the visitors who've come from 40 miles away tells you all you need to know. He's the best player in the house tonight. Better still, your two brothers are in town, right beside you. All three of you grew up together on a basketball court. All three of you were starters on the same team. You can see it in their faces. They're reliving it, too. Everyone filing in, it seems, calls or waves to you, the friendly father, the star. Your kid looks up and gives the slightest nod. He's dedicating this game to your side of the family. Got to love that, too. You all rise for the Star-Spangled Banner. Then your son and the other team's big man crouch at midcourt for the tap. Your eyes, like your brother's, like your son's, lock on the basketball, as if you owned your lives to that thing, which all four of you do. Okay, there's something else going on here. The kid's dedicating this game to your sister, his aunt, Suzanne, who just died of colon cancer. No, not a pretty way to die, but more dignified than the face down in the mud on the edge of a South American jungle, like your mother, father, wife, unborn child, two brothers, a sister, four nephews, and a niece. None of you here tonight should exist. Not you, Jim Jones Jr., the one who carries that name. Not your brother Stefan, the one who carries that blood. Not your brother Tim, the one who carries the visual memory of your relatives and friends among the 910 bloated bodies lying shoulder to shoulder, the largest mass suicide in modern history. And no, not your own son down there, the Reverend Jim Jones, grandson. You were spared that day, Saturday, November 18, 1978. You, Stefan, and Tim were teenagers, 150 miles away, playing against Guyana's national basketball team. You were saved by this sport. But then, if you hadn't been away that day, maybe you could have stopped it. Maybe you'd have stood up to your father when he ordered everyone in the People's Temple to drink the cyanide-laced powdered grape punch in Jonestown, Guyana. Maybe you could have saved your family, saved everyone. You were cursed by this sport. His son controls the tap. Archbishop Reardon High begins to run a play. Jim Jones Jr. looks around the gym. This is the last place he dreamed he'd be in his mid-40s in December 2006. This is the last sport his child was supposed to play. The kid misses a four-footer, gets whistled for climbing a defender's back on a rebound, then flings a pass out of bounds, all before the game against San Ramon Valley in the final of the Crusader Classic is 45 seconds old. Focus it, thinks Jim. Focus that fire. His son knows how much Suzanne meant to Jim upon his return from the massacre, knows that a game's more than a game. He barrels in for three layups, then slashes across the lane and feathers in a turnaround jumper, igniting Reardon to a 17-8 lead. He's settling down now, becoming who he is. Rob Jones, San Francisco's reigning high school player of the year. Rob Jones, the kid who keeps that loaded last name glued to his first one so that nobody will ever lose sight or sound of it. Who would he be now if he didn't know? Yes, this had been the million-dollar question for Jim and his surviving siblings after the children were born. Would they tell the kids of the horror and of the relation to the one of the most diseased men in moments of U.S. history? Would the next generation of Joneses have to carry the stain? Jim glances at Suzanne's two adult children, cheering for their cousin. Only on her deathbed a few months ago had Suzanne disclosed her family history, though she dropped out of the People's Temple long before its hasty flight from San Francisco to the jungles of Guyana in 1977. Surely Jim could have tried to quash his past, too. Could have started life over from the Bay Area, the cult's home base, and disowned the legacy, sealed it from his three sons. Jones, after all, was the fourth most common name in the U.S., and he, unlike the notorious father who had adopted him and made him his namesake, was black. But Jim's an extrovert, the life of the party, not the keeper of secrets, a lousy vault. Hell, he'd name Rob his firstborn after the father of his teenage wife, Yvette Muldrow, who drunk the cyanide and died along with her unborn baby. When Rob was a toddler, Jim marked the anniversary of Yvette's death by taking him to the mausoleum where her ashes were interred and letting him play while Jim sat near the urn, devoured by shame that he was alive and she wasn't, because of a game. He knew that one day he might have to pass on his story to his son, but how could he ever pass on his game? Wait a minute. Where's Jim? He's not sitting with his brothers in the upper section anymore. He's down in the lower section beside his wife, Erin. He winces as his son misses a chippy. Outmuscles everyone for a putback that misses as well, and then, damn it all, goes up again. Yes! Jim raises his fist as Rob takes a feed a moment later and slams. The kid's 6'5½", 230, a furniture truck with springs and speed. But Jim remembers the pipsqueak he could lift over his head, back when he still thought he had plenty of time to figure out how and what he'd tell his son. Hell, the kid was only 4. When Waco happened, a 51-day FBI siege of another sect, the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas, that left 82 dead in 1993 and kept TV commentators hearkening back to the last American cult horror, Jonestown. Jonestown? Echoed little Rob in front of the TV. There's a town named after us. I want to go there. Oh, God. For 15 years, Jim had been going there and fleeing there in his head, and finally he thought, found refuge. A nice, numb little cove. At first, of course, that had been impossible. A Secret Service agent, a customs agent, and a treasury agent were assigned to him and each other player on their way home to the United States. He'd been interrogated in an airport hangar the moment he set foot in America, then placed under police surveillance for months while he lived in Suzanne's Bay Area apartment. For weeks he'd been mobbed by reporters on his way in and out of federal courthouse hearings on the Jonestown tragedy, splashed across the San Francisco newspapers, and when people pointed at him in malls, made to feel like a leper. He was 18 years old. He'd swallowed his fears and shown up at a half-dozen funerals for temple members whose bodies had been shipped back to the Bay Area. Then the mother of one of the dead at a post-funeral gathering put a gun to his head and hissed, "Why should you be alive and when my daughter's dead?" "I don't want to be alive," Jim replied. "Kill me now." Mourners grabbed the gun and gave him some advice. "Stay away from the survivors. They'll blame you." Hell, he blamed himself, mostly for having sent Yvette, the pregnant bride who had wanted to stay at his side, back to Jonestown a few weeks after their wedding in Georgetown, while he remained in the Guyanese capital to do public relations and liaison work for Jonestown's economic and outreach projects, including the basketball games against the host country's Olympic team. "So you're Jim Jones, huh?" said his boss at his first job in his new life, as he prepared to head out on his route as a bank courier. "You going to pick up some Kool-Aid on your drive tonight?" "That's not funny," said Jim. "That's my father." "What?" "That's my father." You can't be serious. Jim Jones was white." "I was adopted by him." His boss looked at him and said, "You're fired." Here on the right, it shows a picture of the grandson on his way to slamming in the basketball game. The stain was deeper than Jim had feared. He tried college but quickly dropped out. Too much mind static. He tried the office furniture delivery business alongside brothers Tim and Stefan and former Jonestown teammate Johnny Cobb. He tried Buddhism, Islam, Pentecostalism, and Catholicism. He tried Talisa and Alice and Danette. hasty engagements to three tall, light-skinned, curly-haired African-Americans born under the sign of Scorpio, just like Yvette. He became the last thing that his socialist father could have imagined, a Republican. Why not a new identity, or his original one? He couldn't consider changing back to his birth name. He settled on James Jones, safe but not a lie, and went through 11 years of Kool-Aid jokes from people who never dreamed that a man so likable, a black man, could be the mega-killer's son. Then one day in 1989, after he'd gotten a 2-year degree in respiratory therapy from California Pacific College and gone from hospital orderly to respiratory therapist to director of cardiopulmonary services at a San Mateo hospital, he stared at the name affixed to his new office door. Apparently all the certification initials listed after his name, CRT, CPFT, RCP, had made James Jones Jr. too long for his nameplate. And someone had shortened it to Jim Jones Jr. No, he thought. People would find out. He'd have to have that changed. Something stopped him. Jim Jones Jr. was who he was. Sure, it would be risky. The woman he loved, a neonatal nurse named Erin Fowler, had bolted from his car on their first date just a few years earlier when his relationship to the Reverend Jim Jones had spilled out of him. But she'd calmed down, even married him. He began introducing himself as Jim Jones and letting a few people know that he was the cult leader's son. The dispassion with which he spoke of it sometimes perplexed him, but they marveled at the miracle that a man who'd lived through what he had could come out of the other end as successful and affable as Jim. He felt a little better now, at least. Two places remained off limits. The first was the basketball court, the sport that had taken him away from where 24 members of his family had died, still flushed him with guilt. The second place was inside himself. He refused psychotherapy. The mind's a dangerous neighborhood, he'd say. Don't go there unless you have to. He wouldn't. He couldn't disturb the buried pain because he couldn't be Jim, the charismatic guy with the deep, rich voice that boomed down the hospital corridors. Besides, it was just too difficult to convey to a stranger, even a hired empathizer, what it felt like to be him. The closest he could come was this. Imagine there's a painting of you, he'd say, with the background all there, right behind you. And 20 years later, you're still there in the painting, but all the background's gone. There's nothing behind you. The people, the setting, your way of life and belief system, gone. He'd sink into depression each November, the anniversary of the tragedy. He'd dream Yvette back to life, then watch her vanish each time he drew near. He'd dream that his father was coming after him, then wake up, go to work, and cracked the Kool-Aid jokes himself. But now, it was 1993, with Waco on everyone's lips, and Jonestown suddenly disinterred. And the co-workers to whom he'd confided his past kept asking, "You okay, Jim? You okay? Are you okay?" He started snapping back. "Are you okay?" he started snapping back. Something was bothering him. Something stirred by Waco. So many children, dead again. Something that he just couldn't reach. And now his child was asking about Jonestown. He could dodge it, keep the kid in the dark, but that carried an explosive risk, too. He swallowed hard and started in the shallow end. He started with the story of a minister and his wife entering an Indianapolis orphanage in 1961 to adopt a Caucasian baby girl, only to be distracted by a wailing 10-week-old African-American boy whose unwed mother, age 15, couldn't raise him. Jim told Rob what his adoptive mother had told him. How Jim had stopped crying the moment Marceline Jones lifted him into her arms, and how she and her husband decided right then to make him the first black child in Indianapolis ever adopted by a white couple, and to consecrate their belief in racial equality by giving him his father's name. Jim tried to humanize that man with raven hair and sunglasses in the Chairman Mao cap. He told Rob about the gentle side of the Reverend Jim Jones, his hugs and kisses, his ability to make Jim Jr. feel unique, prized, chosen. Then one day Jim peeled an old family portrait from a scrapbook, framed it, and placed it on the mantel. "See, Rob," he said, "they called us the Rainbow Family. 7 of us kids were adopted, and we came from all over." He pointed to Agnes, an elder sister who was part Native American. Then to Suzanne and Lou, both adopted from Korea, and to Tim, a close family friend whom the Joneses ended up adopting as well. Then to Stefan, their one biological child. Then Jim told Rob about the two who weren't in the picture. Goldie, the eldest, who married and broke ties with the family before Jim was adopted, and Stephanie, another child adopted from Korea, who died in a car crash. He told Rob about the adventures of the Rainbow family, the years abroad in Brazil, Argentina, and Hawaii, and the long caravan that formed in 1965 when Father, as everyone in the church called Jim Jones Sr., led 70 Indiana families to the People's Temple's new home, a tiny hamlet in the vineyards of Northern California. About the orphanages his dad ran, the soup kitchens, free clinics, and senior citizens' homes he'd opened, the theaters, restaurants. And hospitals he desegregated, about his dream that their church would be the seed for a new world, one without barriers between rich and poor, races and sexes and ages. Little Rob didn't need to hear the messy details, not yet. Didn't need to know that it was Grandpa's raging paranoia that drove the Rainbow family to Belo Horizonte, Brazil, and then to Redwood Valley, California, two sites listed in a 1962 Esquire article as among the likeliest to survive a nuclear holocaust, that it was his lust for greater power that sent the family and the temple to San Francisco in 1972, and that it was published stories about his alleged abuse of church members that stampeded them to Guyana in 1977. The kid was way too young for that, and besides, Jim had learned something. When he spoke well of his father by day, his father stopped stalking his dreams at night. Rob can feel it now. No one here can stop him. He whirls and powers through two defenders to score, giving Reardon the 30-19 halftime lead. But where's Jim? That's him, slipping outside the gym and lighting a cigarette, sucking hard so he'll have time to light and suck a second one, always dropping out of sight when he can't be the wonderful guy everyone knows. But no, it's nothing like it used to be. Back when Rob was 4, when Jim started heading out for work or an errand, and vanishing. He would drive for hours, tearing at himself. Damn it, he'd been on his father's security team, protected him from danger. Walkie-talkies, earphones, weapons, code words, the works. He would park his car at the beach and pour from a bottle into a plastic cup, hoping vodka work as a solvent on the stain. He skulked back home, wrung out and ragged a day or so later. Waco had started the slide. When his eldest son questions about Jonestown, then the thing that began to appear in the boy's hands, that round thing wrapped in dimpled leather, that basketball. Dad, he'd ask, can we play? Jim took the ball in his hands. All the old guilt and remorse began to seep from it. Selfish, so damn selfish to have been off playing basketball on this family's day of reckoning. See, that was the problem. Jim's father had pounded that basketball shame into his sons even before Jonestown, and then, in the sickest possible way, proved himself right. He wouldn't forbid them to play. He was a master at knowing just how far he could push people, and he seemed to sense that basketball was the boy's outlet from the demands of temple life. He'd shame the boys instead, snort, what a folly, what a waste of time when the world's in shambles and we need it to be changing. Didn't Jim, of all the boys in the Rainbow family, see how exploitive the sport was, how it kept blacks from using their minds to smash the shackles of a repressive capitalist society? The Jones boys' basketball guilt was laced, of course, laced with liberation, a feeling that they were thrusting a middle finger at the holy hypocrite every time they shoveled snow or swept leaves off their concrete patio court and went at it. They'd come home from a 2-hour practice at Ukiah Junior High, grab a ball and play again. Normality. That was the game's gift. A couple of hours to feel like regular kids instead of the cult loonies who'd invaded Redwood Valley. That's what they were doing, playing pick-up ball at a temple picnic back in the early 70s when they heard the gunshot and froze and saw Dad lying on the ground, clutching his chest, his shirt soaked in blood, then waving frantic temple members away once they carried him into his house so he could resurrect himself and have the shirt framed at a temple relic. If only Jim had exposed the fraud when he started seeing it a few years later. But he'd brought it into his dad's vision of just the world, swallowed the old end justifies the means snake oil. The larger father loomed, the farther the world spread, and the more converts, nearly 20,000 ultimately, rushed to the ramparts. Hell, nobody in the temple would have listened to Jim anyway. Its members had turned over everything so that man, their children, their life savings, their homes, and no one owed him more than Jim did. That man had rescued him from an orphanage, perhaps saved him from the life of drugs in prison that would eventually befall two of Jim's three biological brothers, and then saved his life again. Laid his hands on six-year-old Jim's head, Jim's dead body after a drunken driver hit the Jones' station wagon, causing Jim to fly out the back seat window, across the hood of the spinning car, and back in through the opposite window. That's what he'd grown up being told, anyway, that his soul had left his body until Dad prayed over him, reviving him long enough for doctors to mop up the job. And so when Dad took him to the theater one day when he was 12 to see a documentary about an evangelist, Marjo Gartner, who'd become wowing tent revival throngs at age 4, and told Jim that he had the charisma, rich voice, and near-death anecdote to pull that off, Jim said, well, okay. He watched the movie a few times, got the groove. When summer came, he and the People's Temple began piling into their 13 Greyhound buses to go soul harvesting at tent revivals in churches across the United States. In a suit and tie, Jim would take the microphone, the stutter that sometimes afflicted him suddenly gone, and warm up the people with a few parables sprinkled with parallels between Jesus and Jim Jones Sr. Then he'd downshift into his personal tale, the black boy twice saved by the white father, and the whip them, mostly African-American mothers and grandmothers, into an amen. Go, little Jimmy! Tizzy then into tears, then into tongues. An offering plate would appear, followed by the white father himself, emerging to conduct faith healings, often involving removals of tumors that were actually raw chicken giblets. How he had ever let himself get swept up in, Dad, hey, Dad, are you listening? His three sons would yammer, tugging at him on the couch when Aaron was working night shifts. At the hospital 2 decades later. Yeah, he'd reply, but no one was gone. Lost again in the lonely guilt, failing like a flipped turtle to find his way back to sunny side up. Good old optimism, Jim's favorite cleansing agent. Lasted longer than vodka, got him through 18 years in that dysfunctional family. There's Jim up on the runway, above and behind the basket. It's perfect. He can look right down over the hoop. There are no seats up there. The congressman and his entourage departed in a small chartered plane for Jonestown. Jones Boys and Company took on Guyana once more in Georgetown. Suddenly, from all their years together, they remembered the music. Point guard Johnny Cobb began running the pick and roll and hitting the open man. Rail-thin Stefan's sweet outside chop bloomed again. Tim found his old ferocity in his running one-hander, and Jim did the dirty work on the boards and in the lane. The Guyanese coach, his players trailing to the first half, called a timeout to run at them. Late in the game, Guyana's conditioning and depth wore down the Americans, and it won by 10. He's a freshman starter at the University of San Diego now. His coach, Bill Greer, calls him the cornerstone of the program he's building. His point guard, Brandon Johnson, calls him the beast, and his scratched and bruised teammates shake their heads at the intensity and aggression he brings to practice every day. He's like a young wild animal, says Johnson, who goes to the basket with collision on his mind. This sport gave me life, says Rob. That's made basketball more personal. My dad went through so much pain and suffering, and he didn't let it stop him. He went through so much bad. Something good has to come out of it. His life taught me that you've got to be able to get over something. You've got to let it go and build something new. My success, I can show people that things can be changed, that nothing has to stay as it was or as it is. It's giving me more fuel for fire, that I can help people feel motivated and make my dad feel better about his life, too. My father became open about everything, and it's been a positive in his life, so why shouldn't I? If you try to hide something, people can use it against you. If you're open, it shows you're not scared. You can make it part of life. It doesn't feel like a burden. It's one of the better feelings I've had in my life. I've been fine if they'd named me Jim Jones. That would have intensified it even more. He's ready, he says. Ready should any fan or opponent be so small, so enormously small, as to hurl Jonestown at him during a game. Taunt rally me, he says. This kid, says Brad Duggan, his former University of San Francisco coach, who spent months honing Rob's skills in private sessions after his junior season, will end up being a president of a bank or a mayor of San Diego or senator from California. That's the kind of kid this is. Jim Jones, Jr. gropes for words. How can the son of such a father explain what it means to be the father of such a son? How can he explain what happens inside a man after he's been spared and stained forever in the same instant, the obligation to justify that sparing, the despair that one man could ever cleanse that stain, and then one day he realized that someone, almost without knowing, is doing just that, and it is his son. I spent half my life, Jim says, trying to call people that there is a different side to Jim Jones in People's Temple. No one wanted to hear it, but Rob embodies that difference. He plays like a lion, but even more, he's such a substantial person off the court. I don't have to explain it anymore. I just have to say, look, there he is. So I'm proud of all three of my sons. When they're born, you wonder, will they have to carry the legacy of Jim Jones? But there's no stigma on Rob. There's no stain. Nowadays, Jim sells biofeedback technology, which helps doctors quickly identify heart attacks. But he catches himself at age 47, daydreaming about retirement. A daydream unimaginable just a decade ago, in which he sees this old guy with a grizzled beard pulling up in front of an old city gym each morning, balancing a coffee and newspaper as he pulls out a ring of keys and letting a bunch of neighborhood kids, then sitting courtside reading his paper and sipping his coffee while they play. Just some old guy living out his last breath to the bounce of a basketball. Nobody paying him. Nobody remembering his name, unless, of course, his eldest son stops to pay a visit, and then maybe they'll remember. Yeah, that old guy. Rob Jones' dad. That's the end of the article. Now let's turn to making a difference. Page 77. Devin Yada's room is as messy as almost 13-year-olds' rooms, but his soccer trophies are perfectly ordered and proudly displayed on a shelf. He has autism, but thanks to Taylor Bell, the senior at Pulaski Academy in Little Rock, Devin and other children with mental and physical disabilities can play soccer in a program designed just for them. A two-time captain for Pulaski, who had periodically volunteered with special needs children, founded Total Outreach Program for Soccer before his freshman year. My best memories from childhood are of playing soccer with my friends, Bell says. I wanted all kids to have this opportunity. He recruits classmates to be volunteer coaches for 8 weeks in the spring and fall for a one-week camp during the summer. Top started out with 15 girls and boys just playing sharks and minnows, but now more than 50 children are divided into three age groups playing during tightly organized one-hour sessions. Bell will graduate in May and plans to study physical therapy or sports medicine in college, but he has recruited four students and six parents to serve on the advisory council to continue TOPS. More than 100 kids have benefited from the program, and after years of moving from field to field, they now play on the same ones as other Little Rock recreational teams. As Bell, the kids can look over and say, my brother's playing today, and I am too. Another article in Making a Difference. At the foot of Hushin Canyon in his improved community outside Guadalupara. Earlier this year, Ochoa's The Golfer Foundation took full control of La Barranca. It has developed plans to construct a high school in 2008. Golf has allowed me to help all these children, says Ochoa, 26, who has earned $10.4 million on the LPGA Tour. And thanks to Lorena, we all get to break breakfast every morning. Well, that's about all we have time for this evening. Just a reminder that this content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We hope you have enjoyed it. I am John Ivy, and I thank you very much for listening. So long, until next time.